This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Hello, I'm Jay Meachy, you've seen their pronouns. I'm the organizing director at Unite Oregon. And so I'm gonna let everyone introduce themselves and then I'll talk about what we're gonna talk about. So, Ed, did you already introduce yourself just now?
Yes.
I forgot, okay, well, here you go.
I'm Ed, I use he, him pronouns. I work at the Surveillance Resistance Lab, and then I'm also an organizer researcher with a group called Lucy Parsons Labs here at Chicago, member of the Chicago Stop ShotSpotter campaign and the National Coalition.
My name is Julio Mateo. I live in Dayton, Ohio, where I've been actively involved on advocating to end the contract with ShotSpotter. I'm part of a coalition called the Coalition on Public Protection in Dayton. I'm also a human rights activist more generally and a member of the Dayton United for Human Rights Coalition.
Hey everybody, my name is Willie Burnley Jr. I am a Boston DSA endorsed elected out in Somerville. I'm part of Boston DSA and I've been trying to lead efforts locally to get rid of my city's ShotSpotter contract, which is how I got connected to all these good folks.
I'll just grab this, can I? Oh, no, I can't. All right, well, thanks for introducing yourselves, everyone. So I was wondering who right now is already organizing around like police surveillance type stuff? All right, cool. Anyone organizing around ShotSpotter specifically? Cool, all right, well, you should join our coalition, which we'll talk about later. All right, yeah, shout out to all the folks who are already organizing, especially against ShotSpotter, because that's why we're here. We have a national coalition that we will be talking about later, folks from all over the country kind of just meeting and sharing information and sharing tactics, so we can be most effective in fighting against this technology and other technologies as well. So if you want to organize around ShotSpotter, definitely join, but we'll talk about that again later. So let me just do an overview of the agenda. First, we're gonna do an intro to ShotSpotter and also some other police surveillance tech. Often ShotSpotter is like going hand in hand with like other really terrible technologies. So we'll learn about some of those technologies. And then we're gonna contextualize ShotSpotter within like the greater police surveillance ecosystem. And we'll talk about things like facial recognition technology and automatic license plate readers and all sorts of stuff. So then we're going to do like a little strategy session where we're gonna like break out into groups and we'll give folks like a few different situations and we'll strategize like what we can do based off those situations. And we'll come back and after the breakouts and just like report back and then talk about some next steps. So that's what we're gonna do today. And for now, I was wondering if, I don't know if, like, I'm not a Christian anymore, but I was raised in the church, and there was this whole thing where it's like, turn to your neighbor and say hello, and, I always appreciate that, so everyone turn to someone they don't know, do the intros, names, pronouns, organization, city. Cool.
Back.
All right. If you could wrap up your conversations. Thanks, everyone, for being so social. I know it can be kind of weird to talk to people you don't know. So, thanks, everyone, for doing that. And now I'm going to pass it to Ed to talk about basically an introduction to ShotSpotter and some other police tech.
And if someone can close that door for anti-surveillance reasons, because I don't like the door open, no offense.
Support that. So yeah, we're gonna spend a few minutes and do an intro to what ShotSpotter is, some of the technical aspects, but also really politicizing it. What does the tool do? What does the technology do? And then we're gonna take some time, as Jay said, to situate ShotSpotter within the broader police technology surveillance ecosystem, and then also talk about a few other pieces in terms of thinking about beyond just the technology, but how the data operates, because data is key to all this. So let's jump into what ShotSpotter is. So the first thing that might seem obvious, naming what it is and what it isn't, it's a tool designed to increase police power. Might seem fairly obvious, but the reason we want to name that and be explicit about that is that when we look at what it does versus what it doesn't do, everything the company claims that it can do, it actually can't, which is fun, right? So it's not accurate. It doesn't save lives. It doesn't increase police response times and make police response times faster to incidents of crime, quote unquote, right? Even though that's everything the company claims. And there's a growing list of research, a lot of data that shows that ShotSpotter just can't do any of these things. So in Chicago, there was research that shows that 90% of ShotSpotter-initiated deployments did not result in any evidence of a gun crime. In Winston-Salem, North Carolina, it was just reported a week or so ago that since January, officers have responded to 628 ShotSpotter calls and found no evidence of a shooting in 65% of them. Which is a remarkable statistic when the company claims that they have a 97% accuracy rate, but it's also remarkable to have the police self-report this statistic about not having evidence of a shooting in 65% of ShotSpotter-initiated deployments. So it can't do any of the things that it claims. So what does it do? It's a tool for the police to increase their power. And I'll hand it off to folks to explain more of what that looks like.
Yeah, so let me bring this over here. Basically, I mean, ShotSpotter is a marketing scam. You know, as you're saying, it doesn't work, which, as an aside, a lot of police things, like police science, is pseudoscience, like bullet casings, fingerprint analysis, like none of that is actually like real science, but like TV shows have like, you know, made it seem like it is real science. I used to say that it's like fascist astrology, but like astrology is actually real though, so maybe not, but but anyway, so I mean, ShotSpotter, it's marketed as this like cutting edge solution to gun violence, but it's essentially just like a series of like a network of microphones, and it's placed throughout urban areas, normally almost always black and brown majority areas. And you know the app, it's like there's Songza and like SoundHound. It's like that, but for gunshots, except like less accurate, you know? So, you know, it's just microphones that are supposed to be picking up these sounds that are gunshots, but as Ed was saying, it's not accurate at all. And it's supposed to be equipped with this like AI intelligence and like machine learning capabilities. And they're supposed to be able to distinguish gunshots from all these other sounds, such as like fireworks or car backfiring. But we know that's not true. And one of the ways we know that's not true is like in almost every city that has ShotSpotter, they turn it off on July 4th. And so if it's like, if they can distinguish between gunshots and, you know, and fireworks, then why are they turning it off on the day when, you know, fireworks are going wild? So we know that like it doesn't work, and the technology is not as sophisticated as it's meant to be, made out to be. And yeah, like I said, it's a marketing gimmick, and you know, you don't really need to know a ton about technology to know that ShotSpotter is BS. It's relatively simple premise: microphones pick up loud noises, an algorithm attempts to categorize them. And you know, this AI solution is presented as this like powerful tool, and you know, it can make all these nuanced distinctions about different types of sounds, but you know, Ed was saying, the performance, it's abysmal. It is terrible. There's studies after studies that shown that, you know, it doesn't categorize the sounds correctly. It leads to false alarms. And, you know, with the false alarms, the thing is that it's basically paging police to say that there's an active shooter in a black and brown neighborhood. So they're rushing into these neighborhoods, guns blazing, thinking that there's an active shooter because ShotSpotter is sending them alert saying that, you know, there's this, like, emergency. And so it really puts, like, black and brown communities in a lot of danger because we know that, you know, police are not great at de-escalation and, you know, when they feel even the tinge of fear, you know, they're cowards. You know, they go buck wild with their weapons, and, you know, black and brown communities suffer as a result. So, did I cover all my things? I think so. Yeah. So with that, I will pass it to Willie.
Yeah, and just to repeat what Jay said, you don't have to be a technological genius to understand ShotSpotter. You just have to put on your socialist hat. It's a product. It's sold by a company named SoundThinking, which was once called ShotSpotter, but ShotSpotter got such a bad rap, they changed their name. Always a great sign. And it's a product that they sell, you know, primarily, at least in my experience as a legislator, to local governments and pretty much to their police departments. And the company itself, it makes money through those contracts, but also through the data that they collect on our communities and how they share and sell that data. It's really, really important to just emphasize that it does not reduce gun violence. They used to market themselves as reducing gun violence. They have stopped marketing themselves as reducing gun violence because there's just no statistical evidence to show that that is the case. But, you know, they say, you know, sex sells. Fear doesn't do so bad either. And so when you think about the way that data around gun violence, even, you know, falsified, over-exaggerated data, can be used to profit some of these companies in the world, it kind of gives you a sense of the enormous pool of organizations that might want to get their hands on this data about our communities. And ShotSpotter is not SoundThinking's only product. They also have a product that was once called ShotSpotter Connect. They changed its name to Resource Router. And that is a technology that, you know, takes the data that ShotSpotter has, where there are supposedly gunshots. It then creates these, you know, hotspots and says, you know, you're more likely to see gunshots over here, over here, over there. You should maybe put more police resources in these area. And as you can all imagine, all this does is reinforce racist police practices. The locations of ShotSpotter sensors are secret. They don't tell legislators such as myself. I'm in a city with ShotSpotter. They never told us where they put them. We found out where some of them were when Wired put out this landmark piece earlier this year that kind of showed that I believe is like over 70% of these sensors are in majority black and brown neighborhoods. And they get placed there based on historical policing data. And as you can think, if you think, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, how police departments were operating and how they still operate, this data is built into a racist police framework that they can now justify using a technology. And with that, I think I'm going to pass it off to somebody else now.
Yeah, so I think just to build on the same theme, so it's clear through research and data that ShotSpotter doesn't work when it comes to reducing gun violence, to increasing safety. But the question is, like, why does police still want it? Why does the company doesn't care about the lack of accuracy after all these years? And there is something that ShotSpotter does do, and I think Jay alluded to it, is that it works to advance existing practices the police currently uses to legally violate people's civil and human rights, and it protects them from any liability that they might have as a consequence. So Jay mentioned, like, officers coming in, guns blazing, What ShotSpotter does is it sends officers on a high priority call of shots fired that theoretically present a danger to them and to the public. And even if it doesn't in reality, it's still and with probable cause to search and seize people at the scene with impunity. So if anything escalates in that situation when they try to search or interrogate somebody, then they are protected from liability because of what they thought happened, even though we know that 90% of the time, 95% of the time in Dayton, like there was no evidence of a crime when ShotSpotters are activated. So I think it's important to acknowledge that existing practice in policing oftentimes involve, you know, how can we legally, with the protection of case law that has allowed us to do this, how can we legally search people that haven't done anything wrong? And you know, sometimes pretextual policing, when you do traffic stop and then you search for something else, maybe use a canine to do a freer sniff so that you have probable cause to search a car. In this case, ShotSpotter basically gives you all that. It gives you like the ability to protect yourself because the officer can claim at the time they thought there was a threat to them and to the public. And also, by policy in Dayton, it actually almost requires that two officers deploy and actually investigate, interrogate people, and ask them questions, potentially search them. So it gives them basically a carte blanche to do what they want and with impunity. So I'll leave it there, I think.
Yeah. So now we're going to talk about contextualizing ShotSpotter within the larger police surveillance tech ecosystem. But before we do that, I just wanted to mention something I forgot to mention earlier was in line with what these folks are saying. There was actually a lawsuit that ShotSpotter did against Vice magazine because Vice reported about the fact that in the past, ShotSpotter has altered its alerts to suit police narratives. And so, you know, it's a probable cause generator, but it's also, trying to be used as like a form of evidence after the fact. And so they will alter, they've been known to alter these alerts in order to suit, you know, what the police are trying to do. And Vice reported this, they sued Vice, and of course, so now you can't really find us online because Vice had to take it down because they have, ShotSpotter has a very expensive crack legal team and they will go after you. So another thing I feel like it's important to mention is like, you know, we're talking a lot about like the accuracy and like how it's not very accurate, but like, even if it was accurate, you know, we don't want it, you know? The fact is like, even if it was like 100% accurate of like, you know, every time there was a gunshot, it was sending folks out there, like it's still endangering people by sending police to our neighborhoods. Like it's still not something that we wouldn't want to make the accuracy better. We won't have less surveillance. So just wanted to, you know, make that clear before we go into some other types of surveillance tech, which is the same for these kind of tech as well. Like we don't want to make them more accurate because it's just going to mean, you know, more police harm against our communities. So so now I wanted to talk a little bit about some facial recognition technology. Anyone familiar with the concept of facial recognition technology? Yeah, I mean, it's basically, it's a tool. It's often deployed alongside ShotSpotter, and the idea is that, you know, it like uses little different points on the face to be able to like tell who is who, and you know, it's often drawing from like a database. And thing about the facial recognition technology, again, it's another thing that's touted as this like powerful AI-driven tool and can identify individuals in real time. But you know, this technology is fraught with inaccuracies. Again, like I said, we don't want it to be more accurate, but it's important to note that it is very inaccurate, particularly when identifying people of color. And there's a really famous study by Timnit Jebru, who was the former co-lead of Google's ethical AI team, which, to be honest, ethical AI sounds kind of like an oxymoron. Like, that makes no sense to me. Also, like, it was interesting because, you know, she was fired after she got this report. She had this groundbreaking paper, and it showed that facial recognition technology is awful at identifying specifically Black women compared to, like, white men. And, you know, as a result of this paper about Google AI, she was fired. And, you know, no disrespect to her at all, like her work is amazing, but like what did she expect was gonna happen? Like Google's gonna be like, oh, thanks for telling us our product's evil, here's a raise, like, you know? So yes, of course, they fired her because she would not alter her paper to say that actually this technology is not so bad, you know. So, but her findings, she found that she measured a couple different types of AI. And one that was really bad in particular was IBM's, and they found that it was 34.4 percentage points worse at identifying dark-skinned women versus light-skinned men. And you know, this really set off this like debate about whether facial recognition technology is accurate or is good. And IBM actually attempted to like fix the issue. So they were like, you know what, this is terrible, this bias problem. So they released this new data set, it's called Diversity in Faces, and it contained over like 1 million face images. Come to find out, like, they scraped this from Flickr without people's consent. So they're like, oh, don't worry, we're gonna get more diverse faces to train it, but without people's consent, and stealing people's pictures off the internet. So like, obviously that's even worse, like we don't want that either. And you know, it really triggered a bunch of more discussions about facial recognition technology. They ended up stopping their program altogether because you know they got such bad press about it, thankfully. But yeah, and Amazon had a similar tech with similar numbers where it was terrible at recognizing women of color, specifically black women, in comparison to white men. And so you know, there's really two ways to think about like how this technology hurts people, like. One is by not working, by having these higher error rates for people of color, it's putting people at greater risk. But also, like when it does work, you know, like when it's this perfect system, it's easily weaponized against like black communities to harass them. And you know, that's a whole separate issue. And yeah, now I'm gonna pass off to Julio to talk about automated license plate readers.
Can I say one thing? If folks have questions, we're going to have a few minutes for questions after we finish this section. So just write them down, hold them. But yeah, Julio.
Yeah, so license plate readers are basically cameras that take pictures of vehicles that drive by them. They may be fixed to a pole or a utility pole. They might be mobile, so attached to a cruiser, either in the dash cam system or attached to the cruiser. And I guess I said, they take a picture of every vehicle that drives by them, regardless of whether they commit a crime or not, and it stores the time and place where it was collected for a variable amount of time that usually depends on local policy. In Dayton, it's 30 days, some places shorter, some places longer. And then officers may query the database to look for the last 30 days where that vehicle was. And they can do that every 30 days. So technically, you know, it has the possibility of them tracking vehicles that haven't committed crime on what there have been. The even though the name suggests that it only scans and stores license plates, systems like Flock also advertise that you can look at vehicles by color or like whether they have a rack, a foot roof rack, or bumper stickers, which means that they are storing pictures and actually searching through pictures, not just license plates. And I think an important part of license plate readers too is that the police can create HUD lists, which they often tell you, you know, as an example, you know, kidnappers or murderers. But the HUD list actually, for example, in and use the Dayton example as policy, it allows police officers to enter any plate into the HUD list. And when the plate is in the HUD list, then anytime any cruiser or any license plate reader detects it, there is also dispatch call basically that sends officers there, or at least an alert to the police department. So any officer can enter a license plate in the HUD list. And if the officer enters a place in the HUD list for law enforcement purposes, according to Dayton policy at least, which could mean a lot of things like that vehicle is suspicious or that person is suspicious, then it stays in the HUD list. And anytime a vehicle drives by a license plate reader, it alerts the police that then responds to that. And again, very little oversight and regulation of that stuff. But again, I just wanted my role here is to explain how license plate readers work. Again, the accuracy is not very high, but we also have very little data about it because we don't really get access to be able to do research on it. So, sorry. The next person, I think, is you, James, maybe?
It's me.
Sorry.
So, no. So the hot new police surveillance technology that might be coming to your city, your community, I think we should all be really excited for. Drones as first responders. Has anyone heard of this? Yeah, it's pretty exciting, I know. You know, it's this is a pitch that's very much driven by the industry. It's very much driven by the companies that are selling drones. They're trying to create a marketplace for this, using this idea of police forces not being able to recruit enough new officers, and to try to use technology in response to having the short of officers, right? As well as, similar to ShotSpotter, being able to deploy this technology to get to the scene of a crime, quote unquote, as fast as possible and faster than a police officer could. All sorts of questions around this. We don't need to talk about these now, but just wanted to introduce this because this may be something you hear about. Most states have already legalized the use of drones by police in different ways. In Chicago, we're anticipating the use of drones to increase, significantly might be strong, but to increase, especially post the Democratic National Convention, because some of the monies that the Chicago Police Department got for the convention were used to acquire more drones. So it's something that we, you know, we should be on the lookout for. And if we want to organize around it, get at us. Gonna introduce another technology that, you know, thank you to everyone up here for letting me to get on my soapbox for a minute. The next one, easiest form of surveillance that police have, social media monitoring. I know we all use social media. This is me getting up again on my soapbox to say maybe we should be more critical and thoughtful about how we use it, because it is the easiest form of surveillance that police have. They not only look at what we're posting, keyword searches, things like that, but also network analyses. So they look at who we're interacting with, who our followers are, all of that. So they can really build a dossier on each of us through our social media presence. There is a conversation to be had about the role of social media in our movement building at this time. I usually tell folks to be very intentional and thoughtful about it, but also have a really clear risk analysis around what you're doing. And to be and to have a purpose for why you're using social media. So happy to talk more about that, but it, again, the easiest form of surveillance for police to have and to use.
All right, now I'm going to talk about predictive and precision policing. And I think Willie was alluding to this, that predictive policing, it uses historical crime data to predict where crimes are quote unquote likely to occur in the future. And you know, this is an approach that claims to be super data driven, but it actually reinforces like patterns of over policing in, you know, black and brown communities. So there's this concept of like garbage in, garbage out. Has anyone ever heard of that concept? You know, it's this idea in engineering that like if you put shitty data into a machine, you're gonna spout out more shit, you know? And so that's basically what predictive policing is. You're putting in racist policing data, and then you're getting out racist policing recommendations. And they don't predict crime. What they do is they predict where police focus their attention. And we know where the police focus their attention already. And so it leads to this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy of continued surveillance and control. And a lot of departments are moving away from the idea of predicting police, or not moving away from the idea, moving away from the term, because I think it's been getting more and more understood that it's not a good thing. And so they're moving away from this term, and they're using this idea of precision policing now, which of course is garbage. And you know, it takes it a step further by targeting specific individuals and small groups who are deemed more likely to commit crime. I remember, you know, when I was organizing around this, I'm in Portland, Oregon, and you know, I was attending some of the like police oversight meetings as they're talking about this, and they're like, there's a concentrated group of 30 individuals, there's these 30, you know, kind of, and they weren't saying super predator, but they're sort of like using that kind of super predator language of like, there are 30 people that are just never gonna, you know, be integrated in society properly, and they're doing all the crimes, and if we just, you know, arrest and get rid of all those 30, you know, 40 people doing all the crimes, then, you know, Portland's gonna be this like safe, wonderful place. And it's like, you know, those 30 or 40 people, you know, and the folks that they had on all these like gang lists, which they had like a gang task force that they had to disband because of racism. And you know, they make these lists, and a lot of these people on the list are not part of gangs. Like, they're not, even if they were, like, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to commit more crimes, you know, like people have a right for a second chance, but that doesn't exist in the mind of police. And so they're making these lists where they determine like, oh, these are the people that are, you know, evil, that can never get better, that are, you know, just, you know, a drain on society, and that we just need to like get rid of them in a sense. And obviously this raises some big ethical concerns, because it criminalizes people based on these faulty, weird predictions rather than like actual actions. And this leads to a lot of like preemptive policing measures and just like entangles people in the criminal justice system without due cause. And yeah, I mean, obviously this lacks transparency, it's prone for misuse, and it just leads towards like a more militarized, surveillance heavy approach that just sees certain individuals, certain communities as inherently criminal, which has been happening since slavery. So with that, we'll talk more about the data, how the data is shared, and I'll pass it to Willie for that.
Yeah, so we've talked a lot about this data that's being collected in our communities through ShotSpotter and technology like it, but where's it ending up and who's it getting shared with? One of the prime examples, at least on the governmental side, for that are these organizations called fusion centers. Sometimes they're called intelligence centers, but they are essentially information sharing hubs where local, state, and federal law enforcement come together. And on the federal side, we're talking Homeland Security, most specifically, as well as ICE, which again, you know, this there you can imagine the kind of implications there. They come together and they share data essentially related to what they say is our anti-terror efforts. These fusion centers are across the country. They're usually near major urban areas. In the Boston area, we have one that is called BRIC, the Boston Regional Intelligence Center. And they essentially, you know, they are in places where your local cops can talk to the feds and be like, there they are, or these are the problem areas we have, and we need resources and we need support. At least in Boston's case, they also are spaces where they kind of coordinate federal grants around anti-terror funds so that they can purchase more technologies and more resources for local police departments. That's how Somerville, where I live, got ShotSpotter. We got federal grants. They're like, here's a free gunshot detection system, essentially. Have fun with it. And we've had it for 10 years because they say, well, it's free, it's fine. It's just another thing we can use to support people, except that we know based on our local data that it doesn't work, and that's information that not only our community has, and really we don't have it, the cops have it, and the company has it, but also state and federal law enforcement have that information now. So, I'll pass it off to Ed.
Sure. And so building off of what Willie was just saying, you know, the Fusion Center network was started post 9/11 through federal grants. There's a Fusion Center in every major city and every state capital. So there's roughly 80 around the country. And the expansion of the Fusion Center network created the demand for all of these technologies and these tools. And this helped to incubate these industries and these companies that we're sort of talking through in terms of all these different technologies, whether it's ShotSpotter and Sound Thinking, whether it's Flock Safety, license plate readers, so on and so forth. And so what is happening now in terms of the expansion of the data sharing, so if any of you are not in necessarily a major metro area, something that might be coming to your city is a real-time crime center. A real-time crime center is sort of a mini fusion center. It has all of the same technologies that a fusion center would have in terms of ShotSpotter and all the tools that we talked about. The level of police presence in terms of having state, county, federal, ICE, so on and so forth present isn't there. It's usually run just by a local police office or police department or sheriff, county sheriff. These hubs are growing, and this is mostly being driven by the companies. They are creating an industry of this. Just last year, the National Real-Time Crime Center Association was founded. It was founded by the largest companies that sell the foundational software for real-time crime centers. So the situational awareness softwares. They started this this association. They're starting to fund it. They're starting to staff it. And they're manufacturing the demand for this. And the point about this, again, is in terms of how all the data from these technologies are, it's aggregated, consolidated, and then shared across different law enforcement. So in terms of how a real-time crime center would operate with license plate reader data, for example, is the software that Flock offers, because Flock not only sells license plate readers, but Flock also has this Flock OS, as they call it, which is their real-time crime center software. Through that software, they share their ALPR data across the country. They're creating the demand, they're creating the platforms, and they're creating the relationships across policing, the sort of the full police apparatus for this. Again, driven by the industry. And I want to emphasize that partially because one of the things I think in our coalition that we're really focused on is the relationship between the company, Sound Thinking, and the police, and their nexus of power. And we're trying to attack that nexus of power to try to drive a wedge between that so that we can organize against them separately, because they have so much power when their interests are aligned. So that's part of our sort of theory of change and our power analysis around the work that we're doing, and happy to talk more about that. But with that, I will hand it back over to Julio. Actually, you want to take a few questions?
Just real quick, I wanted to mention, we often listen to the Sound Thinking ShotSpotter quarterly earnings calls where they talk to their shareholders. And, you know, they love to tell on themselves at these things because they're surrounded by other fascists. So they're completely unabashed about like what they say. So it's actually pretty good for like finding propaganda to use against them. But I remember listening to one call and they were saying how governments are perfect customers because they never go out of business. And like that always sticks with me. And this is why we see such like a growing police surveillance industry and these partnerships, because governments never go out of business. They will continue to get money somehow from, you know, federally or state or et cetera. And they will, you know, like if they can develop these relationships, this is something they also talked about. When they develop those relationships, the likelihood that they'll cut off contracts, that they'll end these things, is low. So all they have to do is get in. They can get in the foot in the door, and they're there forever, in their minds. And even when the contracts are, ended, then they're not really ended. You know, they often leave the stuff in place. So, with that, I'll pass it to Julio.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.